Start the clock, he called. 2 minutes. He kept his foot on the brake and hit the gas until the transmission was wound up tight and the whole car was rocking and bucking and straining. Then he slipped his foot off the brake and stamped down on the accelerator, and the car shot forward. It covered the 42 feet of available distance with the rear tires smoking and howling, and then it smashed head-on into the gate. The lock ruptured instantly, and the gate smashed open and flung back, and about a dozen airbags exploded inside the Chrysler, out of the steering wheel and the passenger fascia and the header rails and the seats. Reacher was ready for them. He was driving one-handed and had his other arm up in front of his face. He stopped the driver's airbag with his elbow, no problem. The four open windows diffused the percussion shock and saved his eardrums, but the noise still deafened him. It was like sitting in a car and having someone fire a .44 at him. Ahead of him on the front wall of the building, a blue strobe started flashing urgently. If there was an accompanying siren, he couldn't hear it. He kept his foot hard down. The car stumbled for a split second after the impact with the gate, and then it picked up the pace again and laid rubber all the way through the lot. He lined up the steering and risked a glance in the mirror and saw the others running full speed after him. Then he faced front and put both hands on the wheel and aimed for the reception area doors. He was doing close to 50 miles an hour when he reached them. The front wheels hit the shallow step, and the whole car launched and smashed through the doors about a foot off the ground. Glass shattered, and the door frames tore right out of the walls, and the car continued on inside more or less uninterrupted. It hit the slate floor with the brakes locked hard and skidded straight on and demolished the reception counter completely and knocked down the wall behind it and ended up buried in rubble to the base of the windshield with the wreckage of the reception counter strewn all around under its midsection. Which is going to make Dixon's research difficult, Reacher thought. Then he shut his mind to that problem and unclipped his belt and forced his door open. Spilled out onto the lobby floor and crawled away. All around him, tiny white alarm strobes were flashing. His hearing was coming back. A loud siren was sounding. He got to his feet and saw the others hurtling the wreckage in the doorway and running inside from the lot. Dixon was heading straight for the back of the lobby, and O'Donnell and Nagley were heading for the mouth of the corridor where the dragon lady had come out twice before. Their flashlights were already on, and bright cones of light were jerking and bouncing in front of them through clouds of swirling white dust. He pulled his own flashlight out and switched it on and followed them. 21 seconds gone, he thought. There were two elevators halfway down the corridor. Their indicator panels showed it to be a 3-story building. He didn't press the call button. He figured the alarm would have already shut down the elevators. Instead, he flung open an adjacent door and hit the stairs. Ran all the way up to the 3rd floor, 2 steps at a time. The sound of the siren was unbearable in the stairwell. He burst out into the 3rd floor corridor. He didn't need his flashlight. The alarm strobes were lighting the place up like the disco from hell. The corridor was lined on both sides with maple doors, 20 feet apart. Offices. The doors had nameplates on them. Long, black, plastic rectangles engraved with letters cut through to a white base layer. Directly in front of him, Nagley was busy kicking down a door labeled Margaret Berenson. The stop-motion effect of the alarm strobes made her movements weird and jerky. The door wouldn't give. She pulled out her Glock and fired 3 aimed shots into the lock, 3 loud explosions. The spent brass kicked out of the pistol's ejection port and rolled away on the carpet, frozen by the strobes into a long golden chain. Nagley kicked the door again, and it sagged open. She went inside. Reacher moved on. 52 seconds gone, he thought. He passed a door labeled Alan Lamazon. 20 carpeted feet farther on, he saw another door, Anthony Swan. He braced himself against the opposite wall and wound up and delivered a mighty kick with his heel just above the lock. The maples splintered and the door sagged, but the catch held. He finished the job with a sharp blow from the flat of his gloved hand and tumbled inside. 63 seconds gone, he thought. He stood stock still and played his flashlight beam all around his dead friend's office. It was untouched. It was like Swan had just stepped out to the bathroom or gone out for lunch. There was a coat hanging on a hat stand. It was a khaki windbreaker, old, worn, plaid-lined like a golf jacket, short and wide. There were file cabinets, phones, a leather chair, crushed in places by the weight of a heavy barrel-shaped man. There was a computer on the desk, and a new blank notepad, and pens and pencils, a stapler, a clock, a small pile of papers, and a paperweight holding the papers down, a lump of Soviet concrete, irregular in shape, the size of a fist, gray and polished to a greasy shine by handling, one flat face with faint traces of blue and red sprayed graffiti still on it. Reacher stepped to the desk and put the lump of concrete in his pocket, took the pile of papers from under it and rolled them tight and put them in his other pocket, suddenly became aware of a softness under his feet. He played the flashlight beam downward, saw rich red colors reflected back, ornate patterns, thick pile, an oriental rug, brand new. He recalled the cord on Orozco's wrists and ankles and Curtis Mawney's words. It's a sisal product from the Indian subcontinent. It would have to come in on whatever gets exported from there. 89 seconds gone, he thought. 31 to go. He stepped to the window, saw Carla Dixon far below in the darkness, already on her way out of the lot. Her pants and her jacket were scuffed and coated with white dust. She looked like a ghost, from crawling around in the wallboard dust, he guessed. She was carrying papers and some kind of a white three-ring binder. She was lit up in short blue pulses by the strobe on the front of the building. 26 seconds to go. He saw O'Donnell run out below like he was escaping from a burning house, picking giant strides, carrying stuff clutched to his chest. And then Nagley, a second later, running hard, long dark hair streaming out behind her, arms pumping with a thick wad of green file folders gripped in each hand. 19 seconds to go. He crossed the office and touched the jacket on the hat stand, gently, on the shoulder, like Swan was still in it. Then he stepped back behind the desk and sat down in the chair. It creaked once as he settled. He heard the sound quite clearly over the siren. 12 seconds to go. He looked out at the manic flashing in the corridor and knew he could just wait. Sooner or later, maybe in less than a minute, the men who had killed his friends would show up. As long as there were fewer than 34 of them, he could sit right where he was and take them all down, one by one. 5 seconds to go. Except that he couldn't, of course. Nobody was that dumb. After the first 3 or 4 KIAs had piled up in the doorway, the rest of them would regroup in the corridor and start thinking about tear gas and reinforcements and body armor. Maybe they would even think about calling the cops or the FBI. And Reacher knew there was no way to be sure of putting the right guys down before he lost a 3 or 4 day siege against the whole bunch of trained SWAT teams. 1 second to go. He exploded out of the chair and out through the broken door and jinked left into the corridor and right into the stairwell. Nagley had wedged the door open for him. He hit the first floor about 10 seconds over budget. He dodged around the inert Chrysler in the lobby and was out in the lot 15 seconds late, through the wrecked gate and out in the street 40 seconds late. Then he ran toward the pale gleam of the Silver Prelude. It was 100 yards away, distant and innocent and alone. The other 2 Hondas were already gone. He covered the 100 yards in 20 seconds and hurled himself inside. He slammed his door after him and struggled upright in his seat. He was breathing hard, mouth wide open. He turned his head and saw a set of headlights in the far distance, moving very fast, coming toward him, swinging around corners, then diving low from braking. Chapter 64. Altogether, 3 cars showed up. They came in fast and stopped short all over the road outside the wrecked gate, and they stayed there, parked at random angles, engines still running, headlights blazing through the night mist. They were brand new Chrysler 300Cs, dark blue, pretty much identical to the one already parked in New Age's lobby. Altogether, 5 guys got out of the 3 cars. 2 from the first, 1 from the second, 2 from the third. Reacher was 100 yards away and watching through tinted glass, and the corner of New Age's fence, and he was dazzled by the six headlights, so he couldn't make out much detail. But the guy who had arrived alone in the second car seemed to be in charge. He was a slight man, wearing a short raincoat that looked to be black. Under it, he had some kind of a white T-shirt. He was staring at the breached gate and gesturing the others to stay well away from it, as if it was somehow dangerous. An ex-cop, Reacher thought, instinctively reluctant to contaminate a crime scene. Then the five guys formed up close together in a tight arrowhead formation, with the man in the raincoat closest to the wreckage. They advanced on it, slow and wary, one step at a time, leaning forward from their waists, heads thrust forward like they were puzzled by what they were seeing. Then they stopped and backtracked fast and retreated behind their cars. The engines shut down and the headlight beams shut off and the scene went dark. Not too dumb, Reacher thought. They figure this could be an ambush. They think we could still be in there. He watched them until his night vision came back. Then he took out the cell phone he had brought back from Vegas and beeped his way through all the menus until he was on the last number the phone had dialed. He hit the call button and put the phone to his ear and watched out the window to see which of the five guys would answer. His money was on the guy in the raincoat. Wrong. None of the five guys answered. None of them reacted. None of them pulled a phone from a pocket to check the caller ID. None of them even moved. The ringtone in Reacher's ear went on, and then cut to voicemail. He clicked off and redialed, and the same thing happened. He watched, and nobody moved a muscle. It was inconceivable that a director of security would be out on an emergency alert without his cell phone switched on. It was inconceivable that a director of security would ignore an incoming call in such circumstances. Therefore, none of these five was the director of security, not the guy in the raincoat. He was third man on the totem pole at best, allowing for Swan's number two spot. And he was acting like a guy in third place. He was slow and ponderous. He had no instinctive grasp of tactics. Anybody with half a brain would have figured out his best course of action long ago. A small, square building, potential armed hostiles inside, three solid cars at his disposal. He should have solved his problem already. All three cars go in. High speed, different directions. They circle the building. They draw fire. Two guys go in the back. Two guys go in the front. Game over. Civilians, Reacher thought. He waited. Eventually, the guy in the raincoat made the right decision. Painfully slow. But he got there, in the end. He ordered everyone back in their cars, and they maneuvered for a spell, and then burst into the lot at high speed. Reacher watched them circle the building a couple of times, and then he started the Honda and headed west. Reacher kept on the surface streets and stayed off the freeway. He had noticed that the freeways were thick with cops at night, and he hadn't seen any anywhere else. So he erred on the side of caution. He got lost near Dodger Stadium and ended up driving an aimless circle that took him right past the L.A. Police Academy. He stopped in Echo Park and checked in with the others by phone. They were nearly home, streaming west at circumspect speeds like bombers returning from a night raid. They regrouped in O'Donnell's room, dead on 3 o'clock in the morning. The captured paperwork was laid out on the bed in three neat piles. Reacher unrolled Swan's stuff from his pocket and added it to the line. It wasn't very interesting. Most of it was a memorandum about future overtime requirements for his secretarial staff. The rest of it was a justification for the overtime they had already worked. O'Donnell's collection wasn't very interesting either, but it was instructive in a negative way. It proved that the glass cube was purely an administrative center. It had been relatively unsecured because it contained very little worth stealing. Some minor design work happened there, and some component sourcing, but most of the square footage was given over to management functions, personnel stuff, corporate finance stuff, routine transport and maintenance and bureaucracy. Nothing inherently valuable, which made it all the more important to find the plant location, which was where Dixon's stuff made all the difference.